You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Good morning, salam. This is Youssef. Welcome to another edition of Palestine Remembered. And in today's episode, I will continue talking about the endeavors, the very long endeavors of Palestinians for independence, and after Nakba, how the Palestinians responded to the most pressing question: how do we liberate Palestine? So without further delay, let's get started. In 1954, a 20-year-old young Palestinian man, originally from Jaffa, who was ethnically cleansed in the Nakba and found himself with his family members, a refugee in Gaza. In 1954, he saw an opportunity to work in Saudi Arabia. To be able to travel, he needed a passport. He applied for a new passport, and a month later, he received a passport issued by All Palestine Government, Hukumat Umum Palestine. He then crossed the border to Egypt, and from Cairo, he took a plane and entered Saudi Arabia with a Palestinian passport. This person was one of my father's friends. His name was Mustafa Ghabayin. But how did he apply for a Palestinian passport? And did we say a Palestinian government? Here is the story. In September 1948, the leaders of the Palestinian movement, having lived the daily pain of Nakba and loss of land and expulsion of people, and having experienced the complicity of Britain with the Zionists, and having seen the failure of Arab armies to stop the Zionist militias from ethnically cleansing 920,000 Palestinians, they convened in Gaza under the leadership of Haj Amin al-Husseini and formed a government under the name of Hukumat Umum Palestine, All Palestine Government. So think about it. Here we are in September 48. 10 months prior to that, the previous November, November 47, the Zionists had control of nothing more than 6% of Palestine. So they went from 6% in November 47 to 78% in September 48. And the only way to stop the bleed was to take the reins of power and to declare independence on the remaining parts of Palestine and to seek recognition from the Arab world as a prerequisite to seek recognition from the international community and the United Nations. That's what they did. They convened in Gaza. They formed a government. They called the government All Palestine Government, and all to say to the world that, yes, we may have lost territory, but our mandate is all on all of Palestine. So the president of the government was Haj Amin al-Husseini. The prime minister was a Palestinian intellectual and a statesman, Ahmed Hilmi Pasha. They formed a government, a cabinet. They formed an assembly of representatives, and they made the call to the Arab countries to recognize them. So here the first political umbrella to seek recognition from was the League of Arab Nations. The League of Arab Nations was born in March 1945. The co-founding members were 7. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Transjordan, and North Yemen. Now, when All Palestine Government sought the recognition, 6 of the 7 recognized them, with the exception of Transjordan. And Transjordan was the old name of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. By December 48, Israel started to attack Gaza again. So the movement, the leaders of the Palestinian movement and the headquarters of the old Palestine government went to Cairo. So here we have a situation where Gaza is under Egyptian custodianship. West Bank is under Jordanian reality. The Jordanian army remained in West Bank after Nakba war. And Israel had occupied 78% of Palestine. Nevertheless, they were able to issue passports and civil status documents, including certificates of birth and death. And they were able to facilitate the movement of Palestinian refugees from their new communities in Lebanon and Syria and Egypt into other Arab countries, including my father's friend we spoke about, Mustafa Ghabayan. The general mood in Palestine was in favor of independence, were in favor of supporting the old Palestine government, and were in favor of seeing the world recognize a Palestinian state on the remaining parts of Palestine. However, there was a group of Palestinians who thought that the best way to protect the remaining part of Palestine, including Jerusalem, was to be under the umbrella of a bigger Arab country as opposed to a newly born Palestinian entity. So there were a group of Palestinians who were in favor of being under Jordanian rule. So the Jordanian government convened a conference in Jericho in December 48, and it was those Palestinians who were in favor of being ruled by Jordan who called for a unity government between Jordan and the West Bank and the remaining parts of Palestine. And that was the pretext under which the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, used in April 1950 to officially annex West Bank to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. I want to quote the former Prime Minister of Jordan, Mr. Abdissalam Al-Majali. In 2005, he said in a public talk in Amman, Jordan, that Britain had secretly promised the Jordanian king to facilitate the annexation. And he even called it the Bevan Declaration. And Bevan was the name of the British foreign minister during that time. So with time, the old Palestine government became weaker and weaker and less relevant. And the status quo in Jerusalem and West Bank was that West Bank was under Jordanian reality. Even though that this move by Jordan to annex West Bank was not welcomed by the region, but it became the reality. So the Palestinians in Nablus, Ramallah, Hebron, Jerusalem, and the rest of West Bank were given Jordanian passports and became citizens of Jordan, including my grandfather and my father, of course. This is why the Palestinian refugees in Jordan hold Jordanian passports, as opposed to the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, and Iraq, where they do not hold passports of these countries, but they hold something below passport or para passport, where it's called Wathiqat Safar or travel document. The travel document is a document to facilitate the travel and the movement of its holder, but it is not a document of citizenship. And then in 1952, there was a regime change in Egypt when the monarchy ended at the hands of the officers. There was a military coup. And because the military coup was supported by the public, so it is referred to as a revolution. So in 1952, a new regime in Egypt was born. A monarchy ended. That monarchy was established in 1805 until 1952. And within 4 years of the regime change, the world witnessed the rise of a young, charismatic president in Egypt, Jamal Abdel Nasser. The rise of Jamal Abdel Nasser was not just over Egypt, but it was a project, a pan-Arab project. And for the first time, pan-Arabism has a political structure, not just an idea or a literature or cultural structure. It has a political structure with a charismatic leader who is not only supported by the majority of the Egyptian public, but also by the majority of the Arabs. And from 1956 to 1958, the Syrian people and the Syrian leaders agreed to form a unity republic under the leadership of President Gamal Abdel Nasser. And hence came the birth of the United Arab Republic and the unity government between Syria and Egypt. Now, after that, the situation in Gaza became automatically under Egyptian custodianship, and all Palestine government came to an end after the birth of the United Arab Republic, the unity government between Syria and Egypt. And here let me pose a hypothetical question. What would have happened had the Arab world and the United Nations recognized the Palestinian government after Nakba over the remaining parts of Palestine, that is West Bank and Gaza Strip? The two-state solution would have taken another pathway, and a Palestinian state would have been a viable and real reality. But I know in politics we don't accept hypothetical questions, but I could not help but to pose this question. You're listening to Palestine Remembered on 855 AM and on podcast. And the song we're listening to is from the Red Sea Egyptian folklore, Ahya Lali, and it is reproduced by the Egyptian singer Mohammed Munir.
Hi, this is Rafif Ziada, and you're listening to 3CR, pro-Palestinian, happily proud radio.
In parallel of the first Palestinian endeavor for statehood after Nakba, the main question among Palestinians, whether they are in West Bank, in Gaza, refugees in Arab countries, was how do we achieve liberation? How do we liberate Palestine? How can we return to our homes, our villages, our towns, our cities? There were three major projects. None of them were Palestinian-led. The first project was Pan-Arabism, nationalism, unity among Arabs, and it says simply that we cannot liberate Palestine before Arab countries are united. So only when the Arab countries, or most of them, are united, then we can be stronger and then we can liberate Palestine. This project saw an appeal among Palestinians as Gamal Abdel Nasser emerged as a pan-Arab hero of unity among all Arabs, especially after he succeeded or perceived to succeed in the nationalization of the Suez Canal and the unity with Syria, especially in the first year. Of course, things took different turn as of the beginning of 60s. And of course, we cannot reduce Pan-Arabism to just the Egyptian-led form of Pan-Arabism, because there were many other rivals within the nationalists to Gamal Abdel Nasser, including Al-Qawmiyin Al-Suriyin, including the Ba'ath Party, and we can talk about that later. So the first project was nationalism, Pan-Arabism. There was another global project, and that was the global revolution, communism, socialism, left in general, and it simply said that we cannot liberate Palestine before we defeat imperial power and capitalism in general, and the only way to do that is to join the global revolution against imperialism. the rise of the left in the world was a phenomenon of the 50s, not just in the Arab world, but the Arab world was not an exception. And then you saw some Palestinians who started believing into socialism, Marxism, communism. They started studying Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, Mao Zedong. And of course, they were inspired by, for example, the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, like in many other places around the world during that time. But there was a third political project, a third political structure, a global political project as a prerequisite for the liberation of Palestine, which is Islamism. The only way to achieve liberation and return is to be united with our Muslim brothers in Indonesia and Turkey and Iran and the Arab world under the concept of the Muslim Ummah. And Ummah is the Arabic word for nation. And the manifestation of this project, there were two different pathways to achieving unity among all Muslims. The first pathway was the pathway of a Tahrir party, where they wanted to reinstate the caliphate that came to an end in the 20s, and they said the time has come for us to reinstate the Muslim caliphate, and the only way of doing that is from the top down. You seize power, you take the reins of power, and then you achieve unity among Muslims under the banner of the caliphate as a prerequisite of the liberation of Palestine. On the other hand, another Islamist project was to bring about change, but from the bottom up, which is you start from the family, you influence family values, the family influences another family, and then it becomes a neighborhood, and then it becomes a society, and all that under direction of a movement, a global network of movement. And this is the recipe of the Muslim Brotherhood al-Ikhwan al-Muslimun, where they bring about change from the bottom up. And then when you have a social reformation, then you lead the liberation of Palestine. So this concept of Islamic Ummah as a prerequisite of liberation had an appeal among some Palestinians. And the three projects, nationalist, communist, Islamist, none of them were Palestinian-led, but they all raised the slogan of liberation of Palestine. And the Palestinian youth in the 50s and early 60s were mobilized mainly to be under one of these three big umbrellas or political projects. In parallel with that, and in different pathways, a group of Palestinian revolutionaries started to develop the idea of a Palestinian-led group or movement or party. And they started exchanging ideas, mobilizing their thoughts, maybe raising funds towards what later became a Fatah movement and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And that started brewing from mid-50s onwards in many countries around the world, especially the Gulf countries, especially Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. So you had Yasser Arafat, a civil engineer in Kuwait in the 50s. And also you have George Habash, a Palestinian medical doctor in Lebanon. And also you have some intellectuals and people of literature like Ghassan Kanafani, who was a novelist and later became or played a political role, and many, many, many other Palestinians who explored the possibility of starting a Palestinian-led revolution as opposed to a regional or global-led revolution. This is not to say that these revolutionaries were not impacted or influenced or even members of regional or global projects. In fact, the majority of maybe all of them were members of one of these three projects. As an example, Yasser Arafat Abu Ammar was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, so was Salah Khalaf and many other revolutionaries. But then something happened in 1962. The Algerian revolution triumphed after 7 years of grand revolution in Algeria against the French army, against the colonizers, and they defeated France and forced it to withdraw and to end its 130-year-old occupation of Algeria. So the Palestinian revolutionaries were operating in darkness and in secrecy, and while they were brainstorming and waiting for the right moment to start the armed struggle or to start the guerrilla warfare and to declare their existence, they were taken by surprise by a move of the Arab leaders. In February 1964, in an Arab League summit in Cairo, Jamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt proposed to create a Palestinian body and for the Arab countries to fund and train Palestinians to self-rule themselves and to lead the liberation of Palestine. And they called this body PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. That was in February 1964, and then came the appointment of a Palestinian person to lead the formation of the first Palestine National Council. That person deserves to be recognized. His name was Ahmed al-Shuqayri. Ahmed al-Shuqayri was a Palestinian intellectual who was in Saudi Arabia. He was actually a citizen, who became a citizen of Saudi Arabia. Not only that, but he was representing the Saudi Arabia at the United Nations in New York. And he was called by the Saudi government and they told him, you've been selected by the Arab League to lead the formation of PLO. Off you go. I have so much admiration to what he did. So within a few months, he managed to go wherever the Palestinians were, in refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, and in West Bank, and in Gaza. He spoke with the nationalists, the communists, the pan-Arabists, the Islamists, the tribal leaders, the social leaders, the community leaders, and he invited them to convene, to come to the first Palestine National Council. Now, you might ask, did he invite the revolutionaries? Did he invite Yasser Arafat and the other revolutionaries who were working to start their own organic evolution of a Palestinian movement? And the answer was yes and no. Some of them as individuals were invited, but not as revolutionaries, because they were working in the shade, in the darkness. They were working in secrecy. They had not yet declared themselves. So the first Palestine National Council took place in Jerusalem under the direct support of Jordan and King Hussein, and hence came the birth of the first Palestine National Council of PLO, and Ahmed al-Shuqayri came to be the leader of the PLO, and he was seen as the leader of the new Palestinian movement that is supposed to lead the liberation of Palestine. And then came the other challenge of writing a constitution, starting the other departments under PLO, and starting the Jaysh al-Tahrir, the Army of Liberation. And all that happened while the revolutionaries were watching and they didn't know how to respond. Do we support Ahmed Shuqayri? Do we ignore him? Do we confront and fight PLO? So I will answer this question in future episodes. So until I see you the next time, this is Yusuf Ahmed Rimawi wishing you the best of times and salam. على حسب ودا قلبي أبويا راح أقول للزين سلامات سلامات سلامات. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast.
If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.